This is an interview with Congresswoman Eva Clayton in Warrenton, North Carolina on Tuesday, May the 30th. This is Southern Oral History Program, cassette number 5.30.95-EC, side A of the first cassette. Very quickly, let me just sketch the general topic areas one more time, and just in brief, and then we can go into the specifics. I'd want to talk about how the political landscape has shifted in North Carolina after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 65. There are some, Reginald Hawkins runs in 68, you run in 68, Howard Lee wins the mayor's race down in Chapel Hill in 69, Henry Fry wins in 68 out of Greensboro, so things are starting to change. We can talk about those things. Holzhauser, as you pointed out when we were chatting a few moments ago, wins in 72, but that seems, by 76, Hunt's back in there, it seems maybe I was just an aberration, but we can also explore kind of the structural shifts that are happening in North Carolina in those years as the economy and the demographics begin to change and setting up perhaps in some senses what's going to happen in the 80s. I'd be interested to talk about the various roles you're playing across these years. You're very active in seeking a foundation of economic justice to begin to address the ultimate economic question facing persons, less privileged persons in North Carolina. We can, as we move into the 80s, we'll see politics in Raleigh shift quite dramatically after 84 and then again in 88. We can talk about those developments. And we'll touch in that time on your service 77 to 81 in the Department of Natural Resources and Economic Development, or I guess it was renamed Community Development in those years, under Howard Lee's direction, and your work on various fronts during those years. We'll talk about the GOP's reemergence, 84, 88, more recently, and some of the issues that we'll touch on there include redistricting and how it had an impact both at the state redistricting level and then also at the level of U.S. congressional districts and your win and Mr. Watt's win in 92. And also along the way, or perhaps if we haven't brought them directly to the fore, we can conclude our conversation by touching on certain cultural issues. For example, the ERA fight in the late 70s here in North Carolina. Another issue would be the increasing prominence of a certain form of evangelical Christianity in the state's politics, the moral majority, and how that influence or that force has echoed through, say, the abortion rights debate or the sex ed debate in public education. We can also touch on, this would be a more recent development, the Martin Luther King holiday controversy as it played out in North Carolina. So I mentioned before we turned the tape on that other resources at the Southern Historical Collection cover your personal biographical history, so maybe it would be useful if we sort of picked up our conversation around 64, 65. You are here working, doing voter registration work in Warren County. Your husband, I can't remember if it's 63, 65 or 65, 67, makes two runs for the State House, and then in 68 you run for Congress. So maybe if you can take me across the pattern of experiences you were having in those years here in Warren County and then your candidacy.
Well, the 63 through the 65, both my husband and I were active in voter registration, and as you indicated, he ran for the state General Assembly twice.
And I should say, your husband is T.T. Clayton, so just so we'll have it on the tape,
yes,
attorney in Warrenton.
Yes, Theocious Theodore Clayton, better known as T.T. Clayton. Obviously, in that time, you had a lot of issues as relate to blacks wanting to register, but you also had issues related to whites trying to discourage them from registering, making it difficult for them to register. So part of our experience was trying to reinforce among blacks they had a responsibility to go out and try to register, but also had to reassure them that they had to overcome what they were certainly going to experience is the resistance and sometimes hostility on the part of the registrar, making them read the Constitution, making them come back, making them wait, a variety of things. The incident around the time I was decided to run for Congress in 1968 actually grew out of my working with my husband and working in voter registration. There was a project called the North Carolina Voter Project. Again, at that time, Vernon Jordan, who was then with the Southern Regional Council Voter Education Project, was our friend, had come to North Carolina and doing a variety of voter registration activities. By the way, prior to Vernon was Wiley Brandt, so we've been in this a long time. Wiley Brandt was the first voter education project, who later became the dean of the law school at Howard. And then Vernon followed him. It was during the time when Vernon was director, where apparently looking at the demographic data that the Southern Region Council would pull together just to show the potential voters' participation in congressional district. The second congressional district then had a substantial potential of blacks in that area. I think the potential was like, I'm making this up because I don't recall. I think it was in the mid-40s. Mm-hmm. I want to say mid-40s, like 44, 48, from that range.
Mm-hmm.
The actual reality was we had about 22%, I think, on books. But the potential was there. Therefore, it made some sense to use a candidate as a catalytic force to get people excited by registering voting. And he came to...
he would be?
Vernon Jordan. Came to North Carolina to discuss with a group of citizens. And in fact, they met here in North Carolina. I think met here in Warrington. I may be in error, but it's so long ago. But met somewhere near around, if not in Warrington, was in Halifax. And really was encouraging, the story I tell is they were looking for a good man to run. And no good man volunteered, but a very good woman volunteered. And that's really, I did not go that mean seeking to run. You know, just it made some sense in terms of, you know, to for the purpose he was talking about, to have a candidate. Now, I was interested. Obviously, I just wouldn't have volunteered. It was something that over a period of time working in voter registration and supporting my husband and knowing that he would have served well and the right reasons for wanting to serve. And also, I think I had been in law school for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out because my youngest, I had a young son. So I had this time on my hand. You know how boredom, mm-hmm. you think you can do more in your time. So I guess having the time, temptation of time, having the interest, and no one else picking up a challenge, I decided to run. And that was a good experience for me because, you know, it was a big difference from helping your husband run for the state legislature and working on voter registration and happened to file complaints to the Justice Department or, you know, doing briefs for the defense fund, then trying to talk about issues that affect a whole congressional. And so it was a steep learning mm-hmm. curve, and then I had to learn the geography because, mm-hmm. I'm from somewhere else out of the state. So I had to learn the people, learn the geography, and the issues
right.
all at the same time with very little money. So it was a good learning experience. All to say is that it was a good experience. I didn't win, but did well for whatever
mm-hmm.
that meant in terms of having a good experience. It enabled people, though, who were engaged with me to begin to see their potential for leadership. Persons who were engaged with me in Rocky Mount, Mrs. Hawkins, who was my coordinator, decided to run for the school board and got elected. So people who were excited about this potential of this person running, got to be a force where in local communities you saw people attempt, and many of them succeed, in local election or school board, county commissions, or city council. So you had the beginning, if you start looking after 1968, after people got experience in one, it translates into others. And certain the laws were on your side. You could bring in the marshals. The Justice Department was there, made itself so vividly in terms of people saying that if you had any problems in registering, let us know. Any problems in actual voting. So you felt empowered by this newfound participation. And people used that experience, I think, in a meaningful way. And then if you check the registration, prior to 1968, and you look at the registration in 1969, you can see a decisive difference in what we started out with and what we ended up with. We lost, we won, I think, about, some records say we 38%, others say 35%, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I choose to pick the larger one. I think the Greensboro favorites say 68%, I think the Houston Reserve says 35%, you know. Either way, it was the basis for which people knew that they could participate and do well in on a shoestring amount of money, because, you know, no such thing as people give you money for cat. You raised past the hat, went to churches, you went to a variety of places trying to.
Tell me some more about your campaign and also maybe in this connection your opponent, L.H. Fountain. And did I'm not familiar with the specifics of the race, did your opponent make race an active factor in the campaign? Or?
To his credit, I didn't ever see written the word he said that black woman or that Negro woman. You know, the newspaper would say Eva Clayton, a young Negro mother, you know, who has an uphill fight. Badges they use, struggling, going nowhere. But anyway, you know, he didn't do it. I think he attempted to play it down that I had no competition. I think he was above it all, you know. I think this was his 18th term, 18th year, I guess. I think it was his 18th or 19th term. No, I'm sorry. It was either his 18th year. He went on to serve 22 years, I think, 11 terms. But, you know, when you're in that long and have had very little opposition, then someone who's unknown come and run against you, do you dignify it by giving her more ink, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think he tended to, not completely ignore it, but to play it down, mm-hmm. in terms of that. But race was a fact. There was no doubt about that. I mean, it's so much, who is this person, dare think? And then you probably look at a fact in the black community itself. How could she think she could possibly win? I mean, and you can understand that. There was no history. There was no evidence of it, you know? So it's for real. Where you have the many who were excited about that, you had the few who were, you know, doubting Tom's. Mm-hmm. And it came natural. It came out of the experience of the system having successfully beaten even our hopes, our dreams, and our aspirations to the point that we dare dream that any one of us could. How could she? I couldn't. How could she?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Which is the ultimate winning in one spirit. But I think it was good for everyone. It certainly was good for me. I can't help but think it certainly left me a stronger and a probably far more matured person, mm-hmm. and enabled me to be far more competitive,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a result of going through that struggle. As a result of that, I think Gene Fairfax, Gene had been in my life a long time. Gene Fax visited with me and said, you know, you shouldn't let that experience go for naught. And her idea how I became an economic development was that the issues you were talking about are still viable issues. And let's think about what's next. So part of that evolved in my doing the economic development. Actually,
mm-hmm.
we were talking about on a national level, how do you move people?
Mm-hmm.
Was that valid then? Still valid now. So all the other structures in which, so part of that came as a reflection and a dialogue with Gene and getting back with some of the same people around with me. And we start daycare centers, we, you know, try to do economic development activities, you know, get people to think what they could do perhaps, you know, for mm-hmm. themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So when and I think that's life anyhow. I think one experience mm-hmm. leads to another, you know, in terms of that. I did that for a couple of years and I was recruited to
Before we get too much into the Economic Development Corp, can I ask a few more questions about 68? Let me just say for the tape that Gene Fairfax was an official with the Legal Defense, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York, who ran the, I think it was called the Community
Legal Education?
Or Community Service and Legal Information Division, perhaps, something like that.
Yeah, we'll get
and
the
out of New York City, with whom Congressman Clayton had a relationship reaching back into Congressman Clayton's years in college through the American Friends Service Committee. I'd like to ask a few more questions about about 68 and the Reginald Hawkins campaign. Here's a black candidate for North Carolina governorship and the first one in the 20th, first one ever. And he makes a respectable showing.
He does.
And
in many ways, because he made a respectable showing, I made a respectable showing, his great strength came in Eastern North Carolina. And in many ways, he was able to motivate what we call a black belt, because that's where you had the potential of people moving from a non-registered to registration. I remember also during the 1968 campaign, Reginald had, because he knew Dr. King personally, he had invited Dr. King to come down to campaign with him in a registration drive. And one of the many stops, I think there were three stops, one was Durham, I can't recall the other one might have been Greensboro, and the third one was in Wilson. Well, he was to come and to campaign with us. So he had, Reginald had identified, I guess, candidates who had large constituents to work in each of those areas, and I was the one in Eastern North Carolina. We were going to do it in the Wilson area. And there, 2 days before he was assassinated, that we were to have our rally, and just how that was such a chilling effect on not only the campaign, but all of what we were about in America. To see someone that was so beloved and yet, you know, so brutally killed, especially someone who's practicing nonviolent, to be killed by one. Reginald, the campaign manager for Reginald was Judy's partner. What's Judy's partner's name? Ferguson.
Oh, right, Jim Ferguson.
And Jim Ferguson and Reginald came down and said, we ought to go ahead and have our rally anyhow. And it was more of a tribute to King that we would, rather than to be cowered out of having it. We was going to have it at the Rocky Mount Tarrytown Mall. And the Rocky Tarrytown Mall at that time was, you know, a really fancy mall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all this nice glass and all these big stores owning this. They were scared to death of us having that right after Martin Luther King's assassination, because people were on a rampage, you know, they'd rather their storefronts were going to be smashed in as a result of emotion. I don't think they thought we would do it as candidates, but I think they would. I think we wouldn't have that kind of demeanor or objective to do that. But they weren't too sure what our crowd was going to do. And so they met with us to suggest to us that maybe we want to rethink this. But we decided to go ahead with it anyhow and invited them. They ought to come, you know, as a part of that. The community ought to be united, not necessarily about my candidacy, but ought to be united about the fact that people can meet without having any outbursts. And we didn't have a large number of whites, but we did have some to come out. And I think the few who came out came out with some of that in mind. You know, our presence ought to say something in terms of that. So in some ways, Reginald, having run for the governorship, brought that larger role, and Eastern North Carolina for him was even better than Charlotte was for him. So the record showed that he got a very substantial vote, and correspondingly, I benefited from that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So our votes kind of paralleled in that way.
In that same year, the one candidate who's successful in a North Carolina race is Henry Frey, out of Greensboro. Your reflections on Frey's victory, that made him the first black legislator in the 20th century in Raleigh.
I remember that, yes. That was a good victory. And Frey is a very competent person. And I think it's one of the, you know, again, it's one of the many candidates who run, and you have someone who's successful. And Frey was successful, and it's a very good one to have. He was an excellent choice, not that you were choosing among many, but he certainly was, I think, not only was prepared in demeanor, but also in experience, to be kind of the loner, because you had to be willing to be a part, but yet be a loner, you know, in terms of
to go into Raleigh and be the first.
Yeah.
Can you describe in the late 60s, around this time, what the structure of...
Sidebar on Frey. Frey was the one that both Mel and I chose to swear us in when we went to Congress. So that was a good... That was a part of history coming back again.
Sure. Sure. Can you describe the pattern of black leadership that prevailed in North Carolina in the late 60s? Who the major figures would have been, in addition to the persons we've been talking about, and how black political leadership was exercised in those years?
Yeah. Well, Kelly Alexander, in terms of state organization, Conrad Pearson, as far as, you know, a kind of a statesman in the law field, certainly demanded respect among his colleagues. Ministers from various churches, you know, seemed to dominate in those areas. The leadership was not necessarily with the teachers and we didn't have that many. There were with some undertakers. I mean, it appeared that, I don't know if there was a degree of independence for it, but they were several undertakers who also were civil rights leaders during that area.
Let me ask you this. Did Kelly Alexander, who was the State Conference of NAACP branches president and had been a long-standing leader of the state NAACP, did he actively bring the NAACP network into this political fray in 68? Was the state NAACP, you know, directly engaged, or?
It sort of were directly engaged in voter registration. The law prohibits them from being directly involved in anybody's candidate. So in some instances, you would find that the same people may be in two different groups. Warren County would be engaged in voter registration as the NAACP, but if or as a candidate, it would be altogether different, be organized. The NAACP would never endorse a candidate. They were very careful about that. I gather there had been some legal challenge somewhere else. But he as a force and an individual was someone who was very well, he was very visible, you know, in papers, and would come around to churches, and the Baptist Association, I'm not Baptist, but I knew that the Black Baptist group had a very active, you know, group as well.
What was the relationship of key black leaders in the state to the white political power structure back in those days? Who would have been the, who would have had the closest ties, do you think?
To the whites?
I'm thinking of people perhaps like John Wheeler in Durham or Kelly Alexander or others.
I would think John Wheeler would have, because John Wheeler was, you know, the banker, the president of the North Carolina Mutual Association, Spaulding's.
Is it Spaulding?
Yeah.
Spaulding's,
would have had, particularly with the business community, but, you know, of course, I gather you equate the political leaders with business leaders, you know, in the white community, but they would have the ear because they were on national boards. John Wheeler must have served, I don't know how many boards he must have served on during that period of time, but he certainly was perceived as the business leader.
One other question about 68, and this will lead us into developments thereafter. Pardon me.
Yes, sir.
In 1968, at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Reginald Hawkins leads a group up to challenge the seating of white North Carolina, I think that with one exception, the North Carolina delegation to Chicago was white. And Reginald Hawkins led a challenge, which ultimately prompted, there was a deal made in Chicago, as I understand it, in exchange for Hawkins not pressing his challenge too forcefully in Chicago, that ultimately the National Democratic Party would encourage state parties to reform their structure and invite more women and minorities into their structure. Can you share your reflections on that, those events? And
well, I remember that being the proposal, and North Carolina not pushing the full way. I also remember Mississippi pushing further because they apparently didn't get as much of a reconciliation attitude out of there. I remember not having, no one having the opportunity to actually participate, you know, on the floor, you know, as a result of not having credentials. A few people might have gotten gallery seats or tickets to some social or meeting, but nothing in terms of the larger event. You saw those on TV. You saw the violence on TV too. You know that. But what stands out more than Fannie Lou Hamer dominates your, you know, if you have so much you can keep on this computer, but Fannie Lou Hamer stands out as a very dominant force, and as a woman, I guess she stood up in my mind, you know, as a very effective force. It's true that North Carolina pushed that, and they did say that, and I think there was some movement, you know, in that direction. Not enough, but North Carolina has always wanted to have had, and in some way should enjoy, the reputation of not being as bad as Mississippi, not being as bad as someone else. So that would not have served its image well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in their image as well as in the purpose for which we wanted to achieve a larger role too, is not just this one time, but to have something on the long run.
Howard Lee in 1970 is appointed as second vice chair of the state Democratic Party in a newly created slot. There's one for a minority person, there's one for a woman, which causes me to think of a further question, which is, what was your relationship across these years in the late 60s with your a black woman running for a national seat in the U.S. Congress? What type of relationship, if any, did you have with the leadership of the state Democratic Party, and how did that evolve?
Well, I can't recall being invited or having a very formal relationship with the Democratic Party, other than I, you know, go to the state functions. I do recall being invited to the state functions and being, part of the regional, what we call the district conventions, but not having any formal relationship with the state party other than just as anyone else would have. I did serve briefly as the chair of my Democratic Party here. So as a result of that, I became a member of the executive committee and was fairly active in the early 70s during that time. Did 73, I think it's 72, 73, 74, those years escaped me, but did it for two terms, consecutively, and therefore was active with the Democratic Party. But, you know, I've been more active, I guess, in later years, in 70. But from 68 through mid-70s, there was no formal relationship. There was no outreaching to Eva Clayton in any unique way, particularly as it related to any agreement that I had. But, and, you know, that's just...
How about the role of women generally in those years in the state party?
That's true. The women weren't there in general. So you certainly wouldn't reach out to Eva if they weren't reaching out to women in general. They were just making a place for women, period, at that one time. I don't know when the first woman was elected to the national as a national committee person. Do you recall? Certainly was in the early 70s.
No, I don't. In 69, from 69 to 71, you founded and were executive director of the Economic Development Corporation of Eastern North Carolina, a broad-gauged effort to begin to address some underlying economic foundational sorts of issues for rural blacks in North Carolina. Can you describe those efforts and the philosophy that guided your work there?
Well, the idea was to begin to enable community groups to work within their sphere of opportunity, whether it would be in daycare or other community development or issues that would improve the communities where they were. In many instances, daycare was an opportunity where community people could organize themselves. So the model was around daycare centers, and we tried to encourage local organizations to start daycare centers. We encourage them to seek out young people who, if they weren't daycare centers, they have feeding centers where in the summer they have special programs. We encourage them to find out about resources that would improve the building of houses and economic development. So they would get information about Farmers Home. It was a referral. It was tell them about programs that were existing to improve the quality of their lives, or to build a home, or to extend water or sewage. Very few of them were actually business oriented, although we had economic business oriented, actually going into business. Now, the community development issue around starting a daycare eventually developed into business. So many of the community development groups founded then evolved in either Head Start, eventually going to Head Start, a starting OEO program as such, and would do cooperative as well as those activities. So it was a community-based organization seeking to empower community people at local levels to start small projects, mostly daycare, but sometimes feeding program, sometimes cooperative, to provide referral information, improving their home life or providing a house where that wasn't, that was theirs.
Did, in 1972, there are a few things that loom large in state political developments. Jesse Helms wins and enters the Senate. And Jim Holzhauser becomes the state's first Republican governor, I guess probably since the 1890s. And Jim Hunt, by winning his seat as lieutenant governor, stands as the state's top Democratic Party official in Raleigh. And as I understand subsequent developments, in large part the state Democratic Party really sort of fractured and had real difficulties thereafter holding itself together. Hunt put a political machine together of his own, and the regular party structure was left without the same sort of active leadership that perhaps it had had in the past. What was your sense of the party's fortunes there in the early 70s with these sorts of developments? Hmm. Were you an active party watcher still in those years?
Yeah, I wasn't. And interesting, I probably focused more on the fact that Holthauser had won then and probably shifted away from my concentration that Jesse had won. The reason for, I guess, I was engaged with a little bit, at least my husband was, most of the night, but in the formation of the Soul City Project, part of that involved having a relationship with the state. And the question would a Republican governor be responsive to a rural project of economic development such as Soul City? So, got to know a little bit about the inner operations of a whole house of people, find out some of his assistants and their accessibility. I knew Jesse because of and his ideology from his being a newscaster. There was no doubt where he stood, but I just didn't focus on his operation as an elected official in those days, mm-hmm. as much as I focused on the state.
Mm-hmm.
I focused on the federal government correspondingly because from that point I went to Carolina, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was more involved with HHS and trying to get scholarships for young people who were going to trying to encourage them to come to medical school, dental school, going to health profession. So
mm-hmm.
part of my responsibility was to seek out opportunities and scholarships for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of focused on the federal government. Those little niche, I was kind of narrowly focused and trying to do what I needed to do there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a broader view. Had a more relationship, I guess, with the state than I had with the federal government.
Stemming from Soul City.
Right.
I'm not going to ask a lot about, in fact, I probably won't delve into Soul City. It's covered in the Kathy Nastrom interview in there.
Yeah.
I want to use our time for some other issues. But I do want to say on the tape that the Kathy Nastrom interview from 87, you talk about your involvement in Soul City. And of course, there have been a number of published works on Soul City as well. I want to ask about 72 brings for the first time the phenomenon of a number of whites crossing over, they're registered in the Democratic Party, always have been, crossing over to vote for Helms and for Holthauser. But in 76, Jim Hunt wins the governorship again. There isn't a Senate race that year. And my question is, to what extent were Democratic Party officials, yourself, coming from a different perspective, was there any sense that maybe what they'd seen in 72 was a harbinger of things to come, that the Democratic Party would have trouble holding its traditional coalition, that a number of white voters would break off and cross over?
I must say I did not. I should have, but I did not focus as perhaps I should have. I did recognize, though, that there were no blacks who were considering moving to Republican, and that there was indeed an advantage of having a two-party system as far as blacks were concerned, but for entirely different reason. It was not a new phenomenon for me to see people forget what party and still vote the same way. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had all the Dixiecrats that voted for the civil rights, So it wasn't entirely different, but it was a little different phenomenon seeing a governor actually who was a Republican elected, because in some ways the electability was only if you were a Democrat. So, I should have said this is going to boil for the future, but that was not something I focused on at that time.
Mm-hmm. In 1977, you became Assistant Secretary in the Department of the State's Department of Natural Resources and Community Development. Howard Lee was the sole black cabinet member in Jim Hunt's cabinet when Hunt wins in 76. Can you describe what it meant for you as a black woman to go to Raleigh, take a fairly high-profile role in state government, the sort of press attention that followed, those sorts of issues?
Well, let me say that politically, 76 of the year that Hunt ran, Howard Lee also ran for lieutenant governor, and in the Democratic primary had won but lost in the runoff. So you had also emerging is a new emergency of not only black candidates, but a sense that there was some crossover vote for a black candidate because he did extraordinarily well. So by the time he was appointed as the Secretary of Natural Resources and Community Development, Hunt knew he was appointing someone who had fairly popularity across that area. I had served in 76 during the primary, both as a Lee supporter, but also as a Jim Hunt coordinating this area. So I had worked across, I guess, about, well, maybe at least six counties and with some of the other coordinators. So had a sense of the new thrust of economic development and education, both of those candidates won. So you had two candidates, you having two personalities, one being the governor, one being the secretary, who had a fairly progressive agenda for trying to move the state forward. I came to that role after having served with both the University of North Carolina and Soul City. So part of my administrative and as an administrator for university and also as a kind of entrepreneur of ideas from the Soul City Project was pretty well documented. And that came from a controversial project, certainly in some quarters. So I came with obviously some media attention with that. But being a woman also, you know, and being a minority woman added to the uniqueness of it, because I think I was the first Afro-American to ever serve as Assistant Secretary of State. So that in itself, you know, brought, you know, some scrutiny, some attention, and you were expected to carry the load for everything, you know, in terms of that. So in some ways, it was a burden that was unfounded. No one else had to carry that burden, you know, both the gender, race, and since you came from a project that, you know, that was perceived controversial, you were not to create any more controversial. You were to be sterile, without any excitement or anything. But human beings being what they are, that never happens. You mm-hmm. know, you always, you know, you live long enough, you always find a way to create some interest. You know, so it was not without incident, wasn't without scrutiny, and what wasn't without a great sense of satisfaction to be in the kind of hourglass and to be scrutinized and to, you know, have to answer questions you shouldn't have to answer, but never say you have to answer. Mm-hmm. And you come out of it, I think, feeling that you've had to bear a cross that you shouldn't have to bear, but because you had to bear that cross, they made you even a better person mm-hmm. than you would have been. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have to bear the cross. Mm-hmm. Now, I wouldn't ask to bear the cross. You know, no one wants to go through that kind of experience to prove how strong you are. You know, it's only after the fact, you know, that you know you're that strong. Mm-hmm. You know, it's good to be tested mm-hmm. and to know that you don't run away from the fright.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that on moving to Raleigh in 77 for this new position that your sense was that with Jim Hunt and with Howard Lee, the administration was ready to move in a fairly progressive direction. Mm-hmm. Was your sense generally about that time, mid-70s, that prospects were continuing to brighten in a progressive sense? Black political prospects, the prospects for substantive progress in basic economic and social issues in the state? What was your framework? What was your sort of perspective?
Well,
possibility.
You know, given my own experience, obviously I was interested in seeing the socioeconomic development happen for the masses as well as for the privileged few. And I got the sense, both from Howard Lee, as well as from the governor, particularly from the governor, that he was aware that the state had two faces. One, it had a progressive face in the terms of the big cities, but in the rural areas, by and large, it was still lagging and probably, you know, a decade behind in some areas. If you look at the demographics during that time, you saw an out-migration from rural areas to urban areas, and there was an effort, I forgot what he called it, it was, there was an effort to do something called balanced growth. And the balanced growth was that you should have growth in the rural areas as you had it in the urban areas. So that was emphasized in his planning policy that he had. Now there was some resistance to that, but certainly it was an effort to bring along eastern North Carolina along with the Piedmont, all the larger cities. He himself came from Wilson, so that reaffirmed that he had a special interest in that area. Howard Lee, having been the mayor of Chapel Hill, certainly had a framework of social work as well, had a framework of a sense of social equality and a diverse population wanting to be engaged in that. So it was, I think, to have a governor with that impetus to bring those who were disconnected from the urban areas around, and to have a person like Howard Lee, I thought it brought some exciting potential in terms of bringing the state forward.
Not long after you get to Raleigh, the following year, Jesse Helms is reelected, beats Luther Hodges, and then 2 years later, the Congressional Club's candidate, Senator East, beats Raleigh. Of the interview on May 30th with Congresswoman Eva Clayton in Warrenton. I was just mentioning that perhaps you could, looking back now, we can see signs in the late 70s that the political terrain may begin to shift. Helms again in 78, but then maybe in a more important, or a more interesting sense, the successful run by East to oust Robert Morgan as the as a sitting senator, and the Congressional Club sort of rise to prominence and influence. Reagan, of course, wins in 80, opening a 12-year era in Washington for Republican presidents. You, not there, not long after, come back to Warren County and move directly into local politics. Can you sketch your thinking at that time and the work that you wanted to do here locally, and maybe how you were measuring the wider political atmosphere in those years?
Well, I was a little more observant of the national scene when Reagan came on, and just the what it appeared to be in terms of a sense of withdrawal from the social programs to the purely economic of the market forces in that area, not unlike it is today. But in a sense, for me, it was shocking because you had just come from the era of Carter. You had just, and prior to that, although Nixon was there, Nixon, by and large, still had a sense of economic development, had a sense of environmental justice, and not justice, but environmental protection. So there was a move in, although a more business analytical way, it still was forward. But Reagan's was an absolute shift. It was not, I mean, a philosophical shift. I'm not talking about just the numbers of people who were elected, who were leaders, but he espoused an ideology that was definitely a little different from someone, his fellow colleague and party member of Nixon. It certainly was different from Carter. The ideas of leadership at the local level was that you need strong leaders at the local level as well as you need strong leaders at the state and the national leaders, that you couldn't depend all of your, put all your eggs in one basket, feeling that the federal government is going to be that entity that was going to be the answer to all the questions, but it had to be a concerted involvement and partnership with the local, state, and national area. And an area like Warren County needs to, particular areas like Warren County, need to have strong leadership because of its economic condition, but also because of the sponsority of people, the capacity of people. It's so easy to say, I don't want to get involved. You know, I have other things to do. And you do not see people of substance or people who you think would normally be leaders in other spheres taking the time to be leaders. And this wasn't just true Warren County. This is true. It's true throughout the South, and probably throughout much of the nation, but particularly I know it is true in North Carolina and throughout the South. And so my emphasis at this time was certainly strong leadership. The emphasis is on economic development. To how do we build jobs? How do we improve the tax base? How do we find a way to improve our schools? You know, things that give to the stability and viability of a local community, enhancing its economic base in that era. So those are the reasons that we ran. And I think much of what guided me during that period of time, and it, although we certainly you don't achieve all this in any one swoop, but certain evidence is that we moved in that direction by the number of plants that we brought while we were here, the school bond issues we passed. I mean, whether you liked it or not, the objectives stayed on course. Invest in economic development, spend more money in economic councils, approve more economic industrial bonds, and more plants were bought in that few years than it's been bought in any period of 20 years. So we stayed on that course. Also, you had, during that period of time, is a conversion of not a one person being elected on. I had some numbers, five, and there had been, I think, one minority on the county commission before that. Now there were three.
On a board how large?
Five.
Five.
So when I walked in, I was elected immediately as chair.
In 82.
Yeah. So we had some opportunity to do some things because we had the members, but also you had, I think, a thirst for wanting to be led too.
Did the three-person minority majority on the county commission prevail largely across your eight-year tenure on the county commission?
It did.
Yeah. Were you typically opposed by two whites politically, or did you also have allies across that?
I had allies across that.
Yeah, so you were actually then able to move pretty directly. Can you give me your sense of the impact of the 84 campaign here in North Carolina? Jim Martin becomes Republican governor. Jesse Helms beats Jim Hunt in the most expensive Senate race in U.S. history to that date. What's your sense of the landscape for the state party after 84?
Well, it was a shock to me that a popular governor like Jim Hunt would lose. But it also is a sense of reality, I guess, as a result of that shock, is that you couldn't read how people voted out of their fear by what they said earlier. And the fear was such a strong factor in there. If you could make a person like Jim Hunt seem like he was liberal, at best he was progressive, at best. I mean, he was a progressive, but he was not a flaming liberal. He certainly is not one now. Wasn't then. Please know that. He was not then. And here is a person really trying his best to move. He understood the state. He understood it was a conservative state, but he was trying to move the state in a progressive economic base. And he could be defeated when they were seen, he had so much going for him, you know. He had been recognized nationally. He seemed very popular here, and people seemed to be saying yes, but they voted a different way. So what was this? It had to be a fear factor, you know. So part of what you begin to suspect and have a new sense of appreciation is that you could speak to the fears of people and get them to move. And that people move out of a sense of fear, then out of their, people will vote against someone more than they would vote for someone. So you have this sense that of the uncertainty, the unknown, not knowing exactly how to read how people would, in fact, react. Martin's election was not as much of, it was a surprise, but it wasn't. Martin's, although he's a Republican, is not a Jesse Helm. Martin's someone who was across a business section could be either a progressive Democrat or a moderate Republican. I was surprised that there was enough, maybe, structural support for him, because at one time it was thought that he was considered not to be in the mainstream of a Jesse Helms and didn't have that emotional support from the core of the same people. But apparently there was, you know, and so, and yet they were, although they came out of different camps, both won, you know. So in some ways, the reality of understanding both of those is that the Republican had since enjoyed a sense of a larger diversity than we wanted to give them credit for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we're now largely getting into the question of the GOP's reemergence in a more direct sense. At root, how do you explain the party's reemergence? You've touched on the question of fear being now something that candidates could speak to more easily than they could maybe to the hopes or wider ambitions of an electorate. In 86, the GOP doesn't lose any ground in the state house elections, and then in 88, for the first time, they've got a real sizable presence there, and there's a real two-party scrap in Raleigh now in the state house. As you reflect back on these developments, how do you explain this shift in the state's political developments?
Well, some would explain the 88 as not so much as a party shift as a monarch who had come had failed. And that was the long living of a strong leader like Richard Ramsey, who had enjoyed a private, unchallenged tenure. And although I thought he was a strong and effective leader, some just saw that as an immovable target. So you had Democrats siding with Republicans, who Democrats had ambitions more than the Republican. The Republican saw this way as a topple, a strong guy. And you had these ambitious Democrats, I guess, who didn't want to wait their terms and were natural allies. It was a matter of strange bedfellows who had similar goals to get the person out for different reasons. On the Republican one, embarrass and move a strong leader, the Democrat wanted to replace themselves, be the leader themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that couldn't happen, obviously, unless you had a strong minority that you could play that off on, you know, strategy. It's just the reality that you had emergence of a two-party system, or you had the emergence of a system that you could have a smaller system, if not a two-party system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
mm-hmm.
So Maverick emerged out of that sort of environment, and he became the smaller speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Neither side having won, the Republicans didn't really win, but
mm-hmm.
the Republican caused a victory.
Mm-hmm.
It was more satisfying to them because their victory was toppling a strong
mm-hmm.
Democratic leader.
Underlying the shift, the move to replace Ramsey with Maverick and the increasing number of Republicans in Raleigh, there's a substantive political shift that's going on, though, as well. It's much more difficult for Republicans to hold, for the Democratic Party to hold certain swing white voters, particularly when issues of perceived white economic vulnerability or other issues involving race are brought to the fore in a political sense. It's harder now for the Democratic coalition to remain what it was. A lot of these blue-collar whites and suburban whites are shifting their allegiance over to the Republican Party in the state. Maybe that's a trend that's only been confirmed in the more recent developments in the 94 landslide, and that all really came home. Do you have other thoughts on this shift across the last decade, say?
In the South, you mean, in North Carolina in particular?
Sure.
Well, in some ways, the two-party system is a healthy sign. I'm a Democrat, so when it gets to be personally, it becomes unhealthy. Theoretically, it's a healthy sign. I'm not sure, personally, it doesn't get to be healthy, too, meaning on the party side. I think that parties as a whole have become increasingly less relevant as you begin to look at the issues. The candidates themselves don't allow the parties to get them elected. The apparatus is not there. It's at best, it's a paper machine. And nobody who's worth their salt would depend on either party to elect them. So you have obviously parties that are more related to ideology, and I happen to be associated with the Democratic Party, who I think is a party about the people, I hope still there. But even so, there were Democrats who always could espouse the more conservative view and get elected. Now as they clarify that and put a label on it, they're saying they're Republican. Now the question is it healthier now that they are voting and laboring themselves, or was it healthier then when they were in the same tent but voting the other way? I mean, how do you explain North Carolina? We've been voting for Republican president for a long time, and they've been Democrats, so apparently there's been some always voting according to one's preference without regards to party. Something you've had in migration, in particular the urban areas and retirement centers of people who come from a variety of places where there's been a healthy two-party system. People have brought their formal party allegiance, and so they registered as they were. So in some ways, we have emerged into 20th century of a two-party system, at the same time as the parties themselves have merged into less of a relevant ideology or political scape. You know, what determines most of these parties in the long run, election, is that 20% swing vote. You may be registered either way, but always say, I vote for the independent, and whatever grabs them, that grabs them out of fear, grabs them out of admiration, or whatever, that will turn the vote. If you look at this vote as well, I don't have the data before me, nor do I recall ever reviewing in depth in 88 or 84, but I've looked at 94. We had less than 30% of the people to vote in the United States, period. And 52% of that less than 30% made a decision. So you tell me, if you then look at that 20% of the total, you say they're 20%. Less than the 20% of the independents made it. And so the swing vote wasn't a party. The swing vote was those independents. So it's those persons, because you're going to keep 40% or more of those core votes who say, I'm a yellow dog Democrat, or I'm a born and bred Republican, you know. I come, you know, years ago my mother was a Republican. She registered me. She's one of the first blacks in Georgia to register. She was a Lincoln person. Mm-hmm. Lincoln freed the slaves. Mm-hmm. That's what you believed, you know, voted for Roosevelt. You know, so I mean, where is the So part of this is how you cast your ballot and what motivates you, rather than now that we have, you know, it's not so much, I want the Republican, I want the Republican, Democrats to win all the time, all right, it's fine. But at the same time, I have a healthy two-party system, I know democracy is served better. A healthy three-party system, I know democracy is served better. But democracy is served better if I really push my own personal agenda, I'm served better. Because our parties then have to go out and win that 20%. So in some ways, we have to revive ourselves and catch the soul of the American people. I think the challenge now as Democrats is how do we do that? Now, whether we stay in party for the get back in party in the next few years or not, I think it is an opportunity for us now to go and say what it is we stand for, what makes this country strong, who are we fighting for, what's this all about, you know, rather than when they win, you know, against them. Clearly, there is a new turn in ideology, just as it was in 84 when Reagan came, deeper. And perhaps they have been building and we've been ignoring, but when Newt Gingrich says he is about a revolution, he's dead serious. They're talking about changing the landscape of government and the role of government. We don't need any more government than we need, but we do need government. There's a reason for having a government. That's to serve the people, not for people serving it. Well, this new ideology that's here is to say we need to take government out of issues that we've been involved in. We need to we use our fiscal situation as a driving force, and they're absolutely right, so you have to give them credit. We do have a deficit for which we need to be about reducing. The question is about isn't rather reduce the deficit. I voted for the largest deficit reduction that anybody's ever voted for, including Republicans. Not one Republican voted for it. It was the largest last time around. Not one. They took that and beat us with it. Some of my colleagues who were very capable legislators, I served as president of my Democratic freshman class, and I lost some colleagues who took some risks because they believed the fiscal problem was severe enough they were voting for it. They took a beating for that. Now we're at it again, okay? Same problem 92. So the ideology now says we have to have a balanced budget by the year 2000. But within that ideology, we're going to give the wealthiest tax break. In addition to balancing the budget, we're going to give something like $356 billion tax break to the wealthiest. Now, if that is an opportunity for us to say what we're about in a two-party system, so Americans, so I think this may be an opportunity for Democrats. Okay? Not necessarily one to run from. It's an opportunity to define yourself, revigorize your troops, if there were any. If they were paper mache, you now know they are. So, you know, I think it's all time to get lean and mean and move on.
One issue that's continued to plague the Democratic Party is it attempts to define itself clearly in voters' minds. Remains the question of race, I think it's fair to say, and in that context, I wonder if you could offer your thoughts on the question of redistricting, which remains a very hot one. Obviously, it's still active in the courts. And here in North Carolina, we got the 1st and the 12th. You and Congressman Watt, obviously the first black representatives from the state in the 20th century. But many people are calling that into question. There's been legal action and such. Can you summarize your philosophy on that question and those events?
Well, let me share with you that the redistricting is as a result of the 1965 Voters' Rights Act, which says, in effect, every man and everyone should have a right to vote. Right to vote and a right to elect their elected officials. The redistricting comes into play where there has been a historical evidence that can be proven. There has been a refusal or denial of opportunity of minority to run and to be elected. So in the first congressional district, or in North Carolina as a general, let's put it that way, we have not had a Afro-American or Indian or anyone of a minority ethnic background to win in North Carolina. You've had Howard Lee to run, you've had Nicky Michaud to run, you've had Spaulding to run, and Eva Clayton in 1968, and I also ran again. So I mean, there's been a litany of qualified persons who have tried in the old scheme of things, and plus that you've had also a history where there have been documented evidence of actual denying people the right. So under that background, the law allows the North Carolina State General Assembly to make the decision as to how they would reconstruct the districts to accommodate for two things: the new growth at the end of the end of the decade. We had now have 12 districts; used to have 11, so you had to reconfigure it anyhow. And redistricting isn't something new that's been invented just for race. Redistricting has always been here. Redistricting for rural, coastal, urban, Piedmont, all of those are decisions as to where you draw boundary lines, and the boundary lines have been there all the time. In the case of the first congressional district, there were 22 counties originally. I'm sorry, 21 counties originally. And there are now 28 counties. The General Assembly elected to draw those 28 counties. At first, they were going to draw 24 counties and have one district that had a majority minority population in. There was a challenge by, I think, the NAACP and some other groups as well. In response to that, the Justice Department denied the first configuration of the 12 counties. And as a result, instead of having my district starting at Durham and going to Elizabeth City, they stopped my district west at Vance County, took it down Federal to New Hanover. So I now have some 20 district in part, not entirely. So I overlap. My colleagues would be from the 2nd district, from the 3rd district, and the 7th district. I don't know who Mel Watts over this, but that's the legal reference. That's the procedure. Nothing new. Redistricting has happened. We're having a war on words. Redistricting for whom? Now that you said that you want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to vote, redistricting is a dirty word. Redistricting wasn't bad for farmers when you want to have a rural district, wasn't bad for city folks when you want to have the city. So, now where are we legally? There was a challenge in North Carolina. The challenge was to the 12th district, but inasmuch it challenged the 12th district on certain constitutional issues, it also brought in the 1st district. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that the plaintiff had a constitutional right to be answered and remanded the case back to the district court. The district court held it, reviewed it, found that the district were constitutional in its makeup. And therefore, as far as the constitutional question, it is ended. The plaintiff, on the other hand, appealed the case to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court refused to hear the case. There are two cases separate from North Carolina case. So North Carolina is out of the fray. Of course, the General Assembly could always elect. As the General Assembly, drew the lines beginning, if Eva Clayton had to draw this line, I can assure you I would not draw 28 counties for myself. I can't imagine anyone in right mind wanting 28 counties. I have more than one-fourth of the whole state in order to travel. But the two cases that were called up and will be heard from Georgia and from Louisiana. There's a possibility in the ruling of those two cases, there may be some constitutional a question that still may be asked, but as to the constitutional question that was raised originally, that the gentleman's rights had been denied under the 14th Amendment, that constitutional question was satisfied in the district court, and the Supreme Court confirmed that the district court had dealt sufficiently with it and refused to hear it again. And this is only purely subjective, my own subjection is that there probably will be some directions to states and new flexibility given to states. I don't think there's going to be anything about ugly tests, how things look, because now people have started looking at this more closely. They're looking at Vice President Gore's old district. They're looking at the district in Illinois. Had nothing to do with race. How the district looked, at least 10 other congresspersons wouldn't have gotten into it. So the ugliness test is, I think, has been dismissed based on having compared what's happened. The issue on terms of the fairness in terms of providing an opportunity that is unwarranted for minorities to win, I think is the issue that's going to be decided on in terms of how much of a percentage are people given. Is this an unfair percentage? In the first congressional district case, we have something like a 56% minority population. I actually have something like a 49% minority registration. The truth of the matter, I have a slightly more white registered than I have, but I have certainly more than majority in terms of history has shown that the large percentage of minorities just don't vote. So having that large percentage doesn't give an unfair advantage. And I suspect, I don't know the exact details of Mel, but we're probably more like, and furthermore, it's the North Carolina General Assembly majority white who organized this. It certainly was either of us who did it. We are the recipient of the beneficiaries of, or the victims of, whatever they did. And of course, I'm not complaining with the General Assembly did. You know, I just simply say if I had the election to draw a district, you can believe me, I could think of a configuration that gives me almost 56% and not involve 28 counties. So part of why we have such a large district was to protect the incumbents. I mean, doesn't take Einstein to figure that one out. And it has been all the time. I mean, this is nothing new. I mean, the whole issues in Texas years ago with the current General Assembly protect the incumbents. It's always been, makes sense to protect. The incumbents protect themselves. So again, that's not something, we're not suggesting that this is new just for us. It's how business is done.
I know that our time is short. Yes. Let me ask one last question.
Okay.
I want to touch, I'd like your thoughts on the ERA battle in the late 70s in North Carolina, and more generally on the fortunes of women in politics in North Carolina since that time.
Well, the ERA battle that I was involved in was short-lived. It happened early in 78. I think we went to the General Assembly. Now, it had been heating up across the country in terms of trying to get North Carolina to be the state that we're ratifying. So at that point, we were one of the key states to do. If we came along, I think we still had one more to go, I think. So although it was short-lived, it was at a critical point. In fact, many of the national organizations came down to try to push that. And in some ways, I think the resistance was consistent with the pressure. The fortunes after that, well, I think two things happened. I think women were disappointed, angered, and in some ways more determined than ever that some things needed to change. I saw the whole issue of parity of job commission come out of that kind of ferment where lost ERA. Well, something ought to be done in terms of make sure as we look at comparable jobs for women. And so there was this whole commission that was put together, pretty much the same women involved out of that. And I would suspect, though I have no way of proving this, is that some women who might not have run for office were more than determined that they ought to run for office, and that I think it coalesced women in a more determined effort than would have normally been if they had not been engaged in that struggle, from Women's Voters League to other groups who were engaged in that. That was, you know, in many ways a coming out for many women who had not been involved before. So it probably got women engaged in a lobbying exercise that had not been. And then you had the Women Equity, North Carolina Equity, which has grown out of some of the women who were involved. And so you've seen some of the leadership who were involved in other issues who with what entities that are still in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you especially for this generous amount of time that you've given. Thanks so much.
In fact, I gave you more time I intended to. I got involved in it. Enjoyed it.